number you have reached is arranged for outgoing calls only.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yes, I'm helping.
And out in Signal Land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
And we have Alex.
Yes, you do. Good evening.
It's quite a night. All kinds of fun things are happening. Some public, some private, but it's conference season. So everybody is running around like crazy. Bear with us because we have about 20 seconds to get things together. It's a lot to talk about, a lot going on. Any adventures from you guys, technology wise, or just trying to get around, Alex?
Well, last week we talked about the Tornado Cache / Roman Storm trial that was happening in the Southern District of New York.
Was there a verdict?
There was a verdict this afternoon.
My goodness. Wow. What timing. Okay. Well, thank you to everybody in court for waiting for the show so that we could be the ones to break the news.
And that's exactly right.
I can sort of predict from the dour expression on your face that it's not a good verdict.
Well, I would say it's a mixed bag. It's very much a mixed bag.
Okay.
There were three counts. The charges were conspiracy to launder money. And remember, to give our listeners some of the facts here, Tornado Cash was an open source decentralized protocol that allowed financial privacy on the blockchain. So you could have transactions that were routed through Tornado Cash, and it provided privacy on an otherwise public ledger. Was also non-custodial, meaning that they didn't touch the funds themselves. The funds were routed through these pools, and the developer was living in the U.S., working through a U.S. corporation, had venture capital funding from another U.S. corporation. This was all done out in the public and out in the open, and then bad guys started using this to launder money. And then the government brought three charges against the developer of the Tornado Cash system. His name is Roman Storm. And so the three charges are conspiracy to launder money, conspiracy to violate IEPA, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. That's essentially synonymous with sanctions. So conspiracy to violate sanctions, that was the charge that our friend Virgil had to deal with. And then the third was the unlicensed money transmission, operation of an unlicensed money transmission business. And interestingly enough, the jury was deadlocked on the first two charges that I detailed. So money laundering, no decision, jury hopelessly deadlocked despite an Allen charge. An Allen charge is the judge telling them to go back and try to come to some kind of unanimous decision, try their hardest. They couldn't come to a decision on the sanctions violation piece either. But they did find Roman Storm guilty of operating an unlicensed money transmission business. And that's really quite interesting to me, because this seems to, like, you know, this is where I think it is so important to just kind of slow down and say, well, look, there is a lot of legal nuance here. There's a lot of technical nuance here. All of this is extraordinarily important. And if you understand how Tornado Cash worked, because it was non-custodial, meaning they didn't touch the funds, how could they actually operate a money transmission business? So it seems like if the jury fully understood the legal implications of the non-custodial nature of the protocol and the software, that it should be a legal impossibility to end up with a conviction.
Do you expect the jury to be able to understand that? I mean, I can't even repeat that phrase you just said.
I know. This is the problem. This is the problem, I think, generally with jurors and juries and trying to boil down these extraordinarily difficult and complex topics and concepts that a lot of people that are native to the crypto ecosystems and native to the open source community don't necessarily understand themselves. How do we expect 12 strangers off the streets to understand this stuff? And very often the government in particular, or at least one side of a case, doesn't want the brightest bulbs or the sharpest tools in the shed on the jury either. So a lot of the people that have advanced degrees or some kind of experience with open source or software or something like that wind up getting struck from the jury on a peremptory charge because they think they're going to be biased. One party thinks they're going to be biased in one way or another. So you end up with people who really have no idea about anything going in there and they're expected to learn and understand and apply these facts to really complicated laws and jury instructions. And so I really think the jury didn't get it. Didn't understand the nature of this, but I do think it bodes well for an appeal. I very much do. I think an appeal to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals here should be in order, but it's also the case because there was no verdict in the other two charges. The Department of Justice could elect to retry Roman Storm on the money laundering and the sanctions violation charges. Because there was no verdict, there's no danger of violating the double jeopardy clause of the Constitution.
I thought if you had a hung jury, you couldn't retry. Do I have that wrong?
If you had a not guilty verdict, you couldn't retry. A hung jury is essentially a mistrial, and the government can elect to bring the charges again, unfortunately.
I see. Okay. Wow. All right. Well, that's interesting. Now, the charge that he was convicted of, what is the maximum penalty of that?
I believe it's 5 years, a maximum of 5 years.
Okay.
And, you know, it remains to be seen how hard the judge would come down on him for sentencing. After the jury read out the conviction, the government tried to have Roman Storm remanded into custody, claiming that he was a flight risk because he was originally from Kazakhstan and he had means and they wanted him in custody and the defense obviously opposed that, claiming he already handed in his passport, he has deep connections to the United States, and they won on that. They won that argument, so he's not in custody pending sentencing, which I think is a good thing. So I think that may give us some indication of how the court is viewing him, but ultimately it's going to be up to the judge. No sentencing date is set yet, but it could go up to 5 years. If the judge views the amount of money that was laundered through Tornado Cash as an aggravating factor, he could be looking at the maximum here of 5 years. If she sees this as immutable code over which he didn't have a tremendous amount of control, except for perhaps over the front end, the kind of the front door that would allow people access to the code, then I think that she'll come down on the more lenient side. But again, it's all up to the parties in educating the judge or the jury to understand these very difficult technical concepts and making those arguments.
Well, the very simple concept that I think I'm able to grasp is that he is not, quote-unquote, the bad guy that was actually laundering money. Did they ever go after those bad guys?
Well, that's a very good question, right? I mean, the bad guys, we know who they are. The bad guys that they cited to repeatedly during the trial are the Lazarus Group. We know that from kind of hacking cybersecurity circles, of course. And, you know, Lazarus Group is synonymous with an APT or Advanced Persistent Threat Actor group from North Korea. And the Lazarus Group laundered a tremendous amount of funds through Tornado Cash, and other threat actor groups did as well. And anytime there was a large breach of, let's say, some kind of cryptocurrency exchange or bridge or some kind of massive hack, you would see a spike in funds going through Tornado Cash. That was one of the arguments that the government made, not surprisingly. So they're trying to go after the bad guys. But really, Emmanuel, what can you do? You know, this is, again, one of the problems I think that we saw in Virgil's case is that if you look back at the history of North Korea acting out and being a bad guy, you can start all the way back in 2014 with the Sony hack and the Sony breach. Remember that, where they took over and they put the skulls on everybody's computers and they were really angry about the movie The Interview that showed Kim Jong-un being assassinated, and so they decided that they were going to breach Sony and make them pay for this. So, you know, when I teach cybersecurity law at King's College, I teach it through the lens of the great hacks, several of which are associated with North Korea. And if we always think about what happened to North Korea, and I try to teach the students to think about these legal remedies they have. What happened? Well, in the breach, in the wake of the Sony hack, after that breach, we supposedly had and somehow done some kind of DDoS attack on the North Korean internet connectivity. So we like shut off their internet connectivity for a couple of days. Most of that country isn't connected anyway. And then years later, the Department of Justice unseals some indictments against North Koreans that are allegedly involved with this particular breach. That's it. That and sanctions, of course. So there's really no remedy that the government has that's effective to deter North Korea from continuing to engage in this kind of criminal activity. And instead, they are starting to use, as, or continuing to use, I should say, as punching bags, individuals that may have some kind of technical tie to North Korea or have created something that they're using, or in Virgil's case, having traveled over to North Korea. And I think that it's not fair for individuals and U.S. citizens and U.S. persons to bear the brunt of that frustration that they have with these threat actors that are the real bad guys. The real bad guys are not the programmers and the developers that are innovating in this country. The real bad guys are the ones that are misusing that technology.
Yeah, it seems pretty unfair that the government gets a consolation prize and they get to prosecute somebody because they can't prosecute the people they want to prosecute. But they seem to miss the question as to whether or not that person deserves to be prosecuted. For Tornado Cash, I imagine there are quite a number of people, entities who are not bad guys who have used it. And I would hope that those entities, at least some of them, are being listed as examples of why this is a good service and not something that somebody should be locked up for having.
Well, that's a great point. And in the government's opening statement, they made this great analogy. This is right at the beginning of the trial, and they're, I have to say, look, you got to hand it, give them credit where credit is due. I thought their opening statement was excellent, and the lawyer who was representing the Department of Justice made the analogy of, imagine you're chasing a bad guy through an alley. And it's an action movie and the camera is going from one angle to another and it's kind of shaky and you're chasing this bad guy and he's got a black hat and a green hoodie on and he's going around these various turns and all of a sudden you chase him around a turn and he runs into the sea of people that all have black hats and green hoodies on and you can no longer tell where he is. And the government then made the case and said, that's what Tornado Cash does. It prevents you from tracking the bad guys any further. And I thought about this, and I thought, well, how would I handle that analogy? Because it was really powerful, and it's a great image to paint in the jury's mind about how Tornado Cash would work. And I thought to myself and talked with some colleagues and said, you know what, how I would have handled that would have been to say in response to the jury, that image that the government just brought up here about running through these various alleys and chasing a guy with a black hat and a green hoodie going through these various turns and then he runs into the sea of people and you can't chase him anymore. Well, guess what? That's exactly right. That's exactly how Tornado Cash works. In fact, I would like you to keep that image in your mind throughout the entirety of the legal proceeding that we have, or an entirety of the trial. Please keep that in mind, because it's a wonderful analogy. Couldn't have come up with something better myself. But what the government didn't tell you is that that sea of people into which the bad guy ran, those are the legitimate users of Tornado Cash, because you cannot hide if only bad guys are using it. You need a sea of people that are legitimate users. And if one bad guy misuses it, what's the purpose of this code? Is it to facilitate money laundering, or is it to facilitate financial privacy? That's how I would have handled it.
Would have been a lot quicker trial. Because that makes someone, it's like, you know, if a cop is chasing a bad guy into a crowd and the bad guy gets away, does the cop just arrest somebody he sees in the crowd, you know, as consolation? Because that's what it sounds like we're being told to accept.
Well, that's a great analogy, too. That would have been something fun to bring up. But in terms of what's going to happen here in this country, I think, you know, as I mentioned briefly last week, the open source community's really got to pay attention to this particular case, because there's risk now. There's risk that merely publishing or maintaining or contributing to some kind of open source project, even if you're not custodying funds, if there's some kind of value or there's some kind of privacy-enhancing technology that you're creating, if that's then misused by bad guys, this case is precedent for the prosecution of the coders, of the developers. That's what's scary. And I don't know how the Department of Justice can square this type of prosecution with the administration's aims of making the United States a more crypto-friendly jurisdiction and a more friendly jurisdiction for business and a more incubator-like jurisdiction for innovation. You know, and more to the point as well, what about this analogy? We know that ChatGPT and Perplexity and all these large language models, these massive AI systems that are just put out there for the world to use, we know that they're being used and abused continually by bad guys to do things like generate phishing emails, to generate scam-type messages, to facilitate all different types of criminal enterprises, and even to do things like develop malware, analyze source code that may have been breached, go through breached documents and data. Those systems are being misused and abused continually by large-scale numbers of bad guys. What about them? Why isn't the government breathing down their necks?
What about Gmail? You know, what about Amazon? Yeah. There's so many examples in the mainstream where obviously it's being abused by bad guys, yet they're not held accountable. So yeah, it's very interesting questions, Alex. Thanks for covering that story, and I imagine there'll be more to cover in the future. So that's going to be fun.
Indeed.
Now, speaking of Google, Rob, you posted this story. It's from Ars Technica. Google has lost their App Store antitrust appeal, and they have to make sweeping changes to the Play Store. That legal dispute began when a company called Epic got tired of paying Google and Apple a 30% cut of sales. The ruling was authored by Judge Margaret McEwen, who affirmed the jury's verdict and dismissed Google's objections. The record was replete with evidence that Google's anti-competitive conduct entrenched its dominance, causing the Play Store to benefit from network effects, she wrote. These remedies and their scope are supported by the record and the nature of the market, and we uphold them along with the liability verdict and the entire injunction. So it's being referred to as a new era for apps. Google's running out of legal maneuvers to avoid rewriting the rules for Android apps. And having lost the appeal, Google appears poised to take the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, which apparently is what everybody does when they lose. There's no guarantee that the High Court will even hear the case, though, or rule in Google's favor if it does. Google's VP of Regulatory Affairs, Leanne Mulholland, said this decision will significantly harm user safety, limit choice, and undermine the innovation that has always been central to the Android ecosystem. Our top priority remains protecting our users and developers and ensuring a secure platform as we continue our appeal. Well, as you know, one of your users, I'm not really sure how you're protecting me by shutting others out and taking a cut and acting in an anti-competitive manner. Let us decide, you know, let the end users decide, the consumers. Any thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. I was really interested in this story because, you know, I'm an Android user as well. And there are other app stores out there, other ways of getting apps onto the thing. And none of them are easy. There's a very popular among a certain type of nerd, app repository called F-Droid, which is full of open source apps, free software, no money's changing hands. And to get this thing going on your phone, you've got to do more than the average person is going to be comfortable doing. It is not easy to set up, and that's by design. And this is now posing the challenge to Google to compete on a more level playing field. Let other app stores let other app stores clients basically be posted to the Google App Store, so people can just download it like any other app and then have it working. Also allow Google apps to be basically picked up and distributed by other app stores. So yeah, things are about to get very interesting. There's potential for, you know, people to get hold of more interesting software, and we're seeing a huge issue right now in specifically the games community, but also other types of communities, because payment processors have been putting the squeeze on game distributors like Steam and Itch, deciding not to allow them to take money, use their payment processors to take money for adult games with certain types of adult content. And that is being felt throughout the software world and is definitely of interest to people who are now interested in the issue of having choice as to where and how they get their apps. So yeah, this is definitely something to keep an eye on. It's going to be very interesting to see if Google continues to try to fight this, take it to the Supreme Court. It's a big one. It's a fight that's been going on for a very long time.
It seems like Google is consistently landing on the wrong side of these fights. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, when you're kind of an 800-pound monopolistic gorilla, these sorts of challenges are going to be presented to you.
Well, I suggest that we enroll them in a Weight Watchers class and help them through it so that they come out healthier for all of us. Another legal story, actually, you posted this as well, Rob, also from Ars Technica. This concerns Meta. Federal jury found on Friday that Meta violated the California Invasion of Privacy Act. Meta, of course, being the parent company of Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat. Did I have it right? Anything else? No, that's it. Okay. I'm sure there's more. The state's wiretap law, by the way, is what the California Invasion of Privacy Act is. They collected data from a period tracker app without user consent. Yeah, that's not cool, guys. That's not cool. Plaintiffs in a class action case proved by a preponderance of evidence that Meta intentionally eavesdropped on and or recorded conversations using an electronic device. That's according to a verdict form released in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. Plaintiffs also proved that they had a reasonable expectation of privacy and that Meta did not have consent from all parties to eavesdrop on and or record the conversations. That's according to the jury. Now, the lawsuit was filed back in 2021 against Flow Health, maker of an app for tracking periods, ovulation, and pregnancy. Facebook owner Meta, Google, and app analytics company Flurry were added as defendants later. The plaintiffs settled with Flow Health, Google, and Flurry before the trial, leaving Meta as the only remaining defendant. The plaintiff's trial brief said that Flow allowed Google and Meta to eavesdrop on users' private in-app communications between November 2016 and February 2019. Flow app users had to complete an onboarding survey requiring them to select a goal indicating whether they are pregnant, want to be pregnant, or want to track their period, as well as input other information about their pregnancy or menstrual cycle. Flow promised not to disclose this information, but gave access to Google and Meta via custom app events, CAEs, sent through their respective software development kits, SDKs, incorporated in the Flow app. That's according to the brief. Each of the defendants had their own purpose for collecting and using Flow user data, the brief said. Flow uses information to acquire new app users through advertising and marketing, including advertisements based on Flow app users' reproductive goals, i.e. getting pregnant. Flow also sold access to the CAEs sent through SDKs, to other third parties for profit. Google and Meta separately used the data they intercepted for their own commercial purposes, including to feed their machine learning algorithms that power each of their respective advertising networks. It's just, this is so evil. It really is. I can hear, you know, billionaires cackling in the background, but boy, this right ruling. What do you think, Gila?
So this obviously lands a little bit differently with me than I'm going to assume it does with the rest of you guys. I have said this before on this program. I will say this again on this program. If you feel the need to track your period, get yourself a paper calendar and a red pen. Do not give away this information. A fun app that you can log into through Facebook is not subject to things like HIPAA. You want to hang on to that information. This is so dangerous, so scary. And I'm at a loss for words. I'm actually so mad about it. And again, it's something that we've talked about previously, or when, you know, shopping apps track what you're buying and then they're like, oh, you bought this. You must be expecting a baby. And right now, this is not a safe country to be a pregnant person. It's just not. And the more people who can be aware and rifling through the concept of your potential ability to conceive, no, keep that as close to the vest as you possibly can. And just because an app has a cute name and you think it's going to help you, it's no. Like, I'm frustrated that this took 4 years to get through. I, again, cannot stress enough that, oh my, this is terrifying and terrible. In other words, start with terror.
Yeah, for those who might be having trouble following what Gila is saying as far as being in danger, maybe in New York you feel safe, but in a state like Texas, a state like Florida, that kind of information could certainly be used against you if you decide to make a decision based on your own body that you have every right to do. Well, there are people there who think you don't have that right and will come after you and imprison you and do all kinds of horrible things.
And it's beyond if you make a decision. If there are things that your body decides to do and you happen to be in a state where it's that could be held against you in certain places, it's not great to give away your private health information in the best of circumstances. This is not the best of circumstances right now for people who menstruate. And it's just not.
The other thing you mentioned was that this is not subject to HIPAA. And maybe could you briefly explain, because people might think it is, you know, if you're entering your health information online, it's just like you're entering your health information online when you see your doctor. Why is this not subject to the same rules?
Because it's not an official thing. You don't have to, you know, when I sign into my chart to get my blood test results, there are lots of notifications and other pieces that I have to pay attention to because it's my doctor's office and my doctor's office is subject to that. Flow Health is just, hey, we thought we'll be cute and make a period tracker. It's not official in any way except, hey, it's going to feed your period information to Facebook.
Yeah, communications between you and your health provider can be a protected thing, while communications between you and some app you decide to put a bunch of info in do not have those same protections. And when it comes to personal health information, in general, you know, if you put your credit card number into an app and that leaks out and someone gets hold of it and does terrible things, you could change your credit card. If, you know, your email address gets leaked out and you don't like that, you could change your email address. You cannot change biological facts about yourself that get into the hands of people who are going to exploit them unfairly.
Go ahead, Alex.
You know, on a very basic level, I think this case is not surprising at all. I mean, it's such a clear-cut issue of unauthorized data harvesting of sensitive health information, and it violates privacy laws. Therefore, Meta is liable for its acts. But to pick up on what Gila said, you know, it shouldn't have taken 4 years for this thing to make its way through the legal system and finally reach the stage at which Meta was held liable for this. But it really makes you wonder about the massive amount of other privacy violations that are not caught, that are not brought before the courts, and go completely unnoticed. And I would venture to guess that this is just an ongoing thing that happens with these massive platforms that are using other SDKs or software development kits and then call whatever this unauthorized data harvesting is some kind of event that happens within the SDK. And really what it's doing is sharing data without the user's authorization. Let's go back now to the 2016 election. And are we not dealing with the same goddamn thing as the Cambridge Analytica scandal and Facebook and Meta? Now it's just a different name and it's more sensitive data. And what's fascinating to me about this particular case is that the initial lawsuit wasn't brought against Meta. It was brought against Flow Medical or Flow, whatever the hell the software company is that created the application. And it was likely only through the discovery process that the plaintiffs had then realized through the exchanges of documents with the defendants and Flow that Flow was sending the data over to Meta. Meta was harvesting this information and using it likely for advertising purposes. And so therefore, the plaintiffs then brought the lawsuit also against Meta. So I would like to think that this should show these large platforms and show these bigger companies that are engaging in unauthorized data harvesting that they will be caught eventually and that they cannot hide any longer in the shadows, that the discovery process will unearth their bad practices no matter where or with whom they're engaging, so long as there's still lawyers out there who are willing to bring these types of cases to the courts.
Go ahead, Gila.
Alex, I do have a question. Is the general trend toward arbitration going to stop this kind of trial from going forward?
Definitely. Absolutely. I mean, many times when user agreements bind users to some kind of alternative dispute resolution system like arbitration, like binding arbitration, that prevents any of this information from reaching the public. And a lot of those agreements, these cohesive legal wrapper agreements that you're forced to sign on to through some kind of click-through or something like that, they also cause you to waive your right to a class action, to being part of a class action or bringing a class action as well. Whether you can actually effectively waive that particular right is a state-by-state type of analysis that's based on certain states' laws. But yes, those types of agreements can be really overburdensome and lopsided and contain what I would consider to be very unconscionable terms that favor the platforms. So you're absolutely right. And those arbitration agreements will, and those arbitration disputes will cause no light to be shed on this. And that's exactly what they would want.
Wow. You know, it's incredible to me that there is somebody who came along, founded this Flow company and said, you know what, that would be a good idea. And it's not going to cause any problems. It's not going to invade any privacy. And things like this are happening every day. Horrible ideas you would never expect to see the light of day somehow are winding up victimizing so many individuals. We just have to look out for it and spread the word whenever we see something like that. Go ahead, Gila.
The other question, and now I'm thinking about this in terms of Cambridge Analytica, this, which again, took 4 years. Is there kind of a steady drumbeat of an attempt to sort of inure us as a society to having sensitive data and personal data stolen and sold? Mm-hmm. And, you know, are we just supposed to say, oh, no, okay, another breach?
Gila, you're describing our culture today. Because there are so many things that we can look at on a daily basis that are shocking and horrifying that are also normal that we never would have accepted even 10 years ago. And now, you know, we can credit young people growing up and thinking this is the way things have always been and not questioning it. That is how it takes root. So we have to continually remind people of how things used to be and try to enroll them in the positivity of how those things used to be, how we used to deal with privacy and data and even technology, and perhaps get them to also be enrolled in that and not just simply dismiss it as old and outdated, because oftentimes the technology might be old and outdated, but the ideals behind it are anything but. Rob?
Yeah, and you were talking about the person behind this app thinking this must be a good idea. And the truth of the data economy now is that it's the personal information that is the moneymaker. It is that which is the impetus behind the creation of so many of the apps out there. You know, someone creates a free app and the goal isn't to make a toy that people think is fun. The goal is, I want to gather a bunch of data from people and sell that data. What toy can I make that people will want to install and enjoy and not pay attention to how much of their data I'm farming them for now? And I can't, you know, I wasn't in the room when this particular app was made, but so many of these apps, that is exactly the thinking. And when you go to an app store like Google, where it is part of this whole data economy, and on the site run by Google, which is an advertising and information brokerage company, that is, you know, probably the best there is at making toys people like, and, you know, using that to farm data from them. This is the environment, the media environment, the technical environment that we are all living in. And it's important for us all to really be aware of how that's working and, you know, educate our kids, our, you know, our friends, our parents, everyone.
All right. Well, speaking of things that appear to be normal, but really are not, here's another story that Rob posted to our list. You know, Rob, I'm beginning to think you only read Ars Technica because all these stories are coming from Ars Technica. It's good. I mean, you know, they're good stories. They really are. But you know, read the Daily News every now and then. It's good for you. Apparently, there are parts of the Constitution that have disappeared. I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. And this is our normal today. Yeah, there was a deletion on a website, an important website, too. It happened sometime in the past few weeks, and Internet Archive actually is key in discovering exactly when this happened. The text was still on the site until at least July 21st. Deletions were being discussed this morning on Reddit and in news articles, with people expressing suspicions based on which part of the Constitution were missing. The temporarily deleted sections of Article 1 consist of about 650 words, as you can see by looking at Internet Archive version in the past. Now, this included part of Section 8, all of Sections 9 and 10. One deleted bit contains authorization for Congress to provide and maintain a navy and to call forth a militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. Another victim of the temporary deletion was the section on habeas corpus. Yeah, it's kind of fallen out of favor lately. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it, it says, or said. Other deletions included a provision allowing the slave trade to continue until 1808, a prohibition on bills of attainder, which I don't know what that is, and several provisions detailing powers denied to states. Now, fun fact, the Constitution can't be changed by simply deleting passages from a government website. So if you're out there and you have access to one, it's not that easy. It's not that much more difficult, apparently, but it's not that easy. The error temporarily made it more difficult for people to look up parts of the founding document. On the other hand, most people don't spend a lot of time reading the Constitution, as is evident around us. So the attention generated by the incident may result in a net increase in constitutional reading. So that might be a good thing. The webpage in question, constitution.congress.gov. I don't know if that's the default website to look up the Constitution, but it certainly sounds like an important one. Basically, the Library of Congress, who rarely speaks, said this: it has been brought to our attention that some sections of Article 1 are missing from the Constitution annotated website. We've learned that this is due to a coding error. We have been working to correct this and expect it to be resolved soon. That coding error can be found at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. I can give you more specific identity information on that if you need help tracking it down. You know, I say this halfway in jest, but also, you know, I'm super concerned about how things are being rewritten Orwellian style. And, you know, it's not fair to blame Orwell all the time. Orwell wrote about this. He certainly didn't advocate it. But, yeah, just recently, the Smithsonian deleted or just removed entire section on presidential impeachment. I'm sorry, they didn't remove the section on presidential impeachment. They kept it except for one president. Can you guess who? Yeah, Donald Trump had two impeachments, and they were both removed from the Smithsonian. Now, they say it's going to come back, you know. It's just being, fixed, improved? I don't know what possible excuse they have. But right now, you can see everybody who was impeached, except for Donald Trump, where there is no mention of it, in the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian! And this is a physical museum. So, yeah, when I heard that parts of the Constitution had gone missing, I wasn't that surprised. And I won't be that surprised when it happens again. And I think it will happen again. Rob?
Yeah, a huge hallmark of the current administration's effect on the government's websites has been just slowly, quietly taking out information that they don't like and hoping people don't notice. We've seen that on historical sites involving the LGBTQIA community. We've seen that on purpose so many times. Their Scientific American magazine mirrored the recommendations about vaccination that were on cdc.gov before the current administration and the current CDC decided to stop talking so much about vaccines as a good thing. And so when this happened, you know, of course, it may have been a glitch. Who knows? It would be a really silly thing to do on purpose because everyone can find and get and compare copies of the real Constitution. But even if this was a glitch, it's the sort of thing that people are looking for now. And it's the sort of thing that people notice. And it's the sort of thing that we have the receipts thanks to like the Internet Archive and the people who have their eyes open about this stuff to call out when it happens.
But I think it's also really important that everybody keep their eyes open.
Yes.
And if you see something is missing, make a big noisy fuss.
Absolutely. And, you know, the Internet Archive, I mean, we love the Internet Archive, but I didn't realize that that was the guarantee that our democracy wouldn't vanish is by comparing old web pages. But I guess, you know, something that simple and basic, that's what we need. Alex?
I mean, I want to go back to the point that you made about Orwell here and that being unfair to call everything Orwellian. I don't think that's right, Emmanuel. I think it's absolutely fair to call it Orwellian. I think what he was doing was, you know, good old George was giving us a warning about what was to come and showing us the dangers of that. And this is so Orwellian. I mean, this is literally right out of the Ministry of Truth. The Ministry of Truth, where Winston Smith worked in the novel, was responsible for altering documents and revising history to suit party ideology.
Absolutely,
and that's exactly what we see being done here. And the fact that bits of the Constitution are removed from the website, I mean, you can't make this stuff up anymore. It's unbelievable. It also doesn't surprise me that it was Article 1 of the Constitution, because Article 1 really primarily deals with the legislative branch and Congress, and they've basically been absent and doing nothing to keep this president in check anyway. So they, I guess they thought, what was the point?
Well, my point was, this is fiction. 1984 and everything Orwell, well, I mean, he wrote some nonfiction too, but the what we're referring to when we say Orwellian, we're referring to bits of fiction that he has written. I'm just saying, you know, when you say something is Stalinist, you know, you're giving credit where credit is due. Stalin killed millions of people. So when you say something is Stalinist you're talking about rewriting history in various ways and imposing terror, different than what Orwell did. Orwell wrote about that. So I'm just saying, you know, it's kind of weird to give both credit for that.
I see.
Anyway, that aside, we have a couple more stories to get to before we launch into Overtime. By the way, Overtime is on at 8 o'clock on YouTube. Channel 2600 is how you find us, or just go to the link on top of the webpage on 2600.com. We'll be talking about all kinds of other things that we don't have time for this week. And Overtime, I believe, will not be on next week because we're just going to be too busy and crazy and frantic. Yeah, that's a good thing. That's fun. It's always fun. This is an interesting story that is a couple of weeks old. But apparently, Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey has sent threatening letters to Google, Microsoft, OpenAI, and Meta. It's you know, it's kind of funny. Now we have to defend them after attacking them and telling everybody how evil they are. Well, there's always something more evil. So yeah, this guy sent them threatening letters claiming their AI chatbots violated Missouri's consumer protection laws. The crime was when asked to rank presidents on anti-Semitism, some of the AIs suggested that Donald Trump might not be that great on that front. But they gave him number one, maybe, you know, that isn't that what they want? A sitting state attorney is using the power of his office to threaten tech companies because their AIs expressed opinions about Trump that he disagrees with in the name of free speech. This comes from a Tech Dirt article here. Now, Bailey claims this is somehow deceptive business practices under Missouri law, because apparently in Bailey's world, not ranking Trump as the least anti-Semitic president constitutes fraud. He talk about Orwellian. He also suggests, contrary to, well, everything, that this action could lead these companies to lose their Section 230 protections, which isn't really a thing you can just lose. It's not just wrong, according to this author. It's not just stupid. It's a constitutional violation so blatant it makes you wonder if Bailey got his law degree from a cereal box. And we better not say more, or he'll be coming after us. But that's something. Some of these attorney generals are very, very sensitive. The guy in Texas, for instance, I don't want to get into that, but there are some people in positions of power now that are rather dangerous and rather, I guess, high-strung and not really stable. So let's annoy them as much as we possibly can and see what happens.
Yeah, the amazing thing about this is just that, you know, in the general consciousness, AI is so powerful right now and such this brilliant thing. And the more you learn about it, the more you realize it's just a lump of code that is, it's there to generate stuff. It's not there to generate truth. It's just there to generate stuff. And just as, you know, when I type a certain word on my phone when I'm texting somebody and the keyboard app substitute the word ducking for what I wanted to type, there's no one I can sue about that, but I can't also claim that my phone is biased against against spicy language.
I'd like to look at an article from The Nation about a month ago, and the headline is priceless. Trump's FCC chief Brendan Carr is acting more like a mob enforcer than a federal regulator. Yeah, you know, this is another example of these people in positions of power who are doing dangerous things. I'm going to read you a couple of paragraphs of this. When the Federal Communications Commission meets on Thursday in Washington, D.C., this is, again, a month old, the agency will have undergone a drastic transformation in just 5 months. Once a wonky telecom regulator that mostly avoided politics, the FCC is now at the leading edge of President Donald Trump's crusade to turn the federal government into an instrument of its own will. Since January, Trump's FCC chief, Brendan Carr, has weaponized the agency to intimidate news organizations and media companies by threatening their broadcast licenses and launching sham investigations into their business practices and diversity programs. Carr is also racing to roll back FCC regulations, eliminate consumer protections, and unleash further media consolidation. And last week, the Senate confirmed former GOP congressional staffer Olivia Trustee to the agency, giving Carr the majority he needs to forge full steam ahead with the MAGA agenda. Free speech advocates call Carr's actions a blatant violation of the First Amendment and federal law, and an egregious and unprecedented abuse of the agency's power. A bipartisan group of former FCC commissioners recently accused Carr of turning the agency into the White House's personal censor. In addition to cracking down on disfavored speech, the agency has already begun offering favors like merger approvals to media companies in exchange for their loyalty to the president. Now, keep in mind, this happened before the Paramount merger was approved after Steve Colbert was canceled. So, yeah, acting like a mob enforcer, the evidence is pouring in, and it's scary times that we're living in right now. But it's important that we continue to notice them and share the information. Alex?
mean, this is why we need checks and balances. This is why we need advocacy groups. This is why we need states' attorneys generals, and why we need private party litigants to try to keep these federal agencies in check when we have somebody like Trump in power that's trying to weaponize these agencies and use them for his own political means. These are very, very powerful agencies, and when they exceed their lawful authority, they are, in essence, doing exactly what the Trump administration says it would like to end. They're creating a type of administrative state by abusing these powers that have been devolved to it. So, I mean, I think we are, again, going to be relying on federal district court judges to uphold the Constitution and keep these players in check.
Go ahead, Kyle.
Well, I just wanted to point out, is it any wonder that community-based efforts, things that are for people instead of the interests of shareholders or massive conglomerates that are consolidating ever more power that then can be abused? Is it any wonder that there's a turn to the grassroots, to the people that, you know, don't necessarily have individual vertical power in these sort of fights between titans of industry, but they're the people that those in industry want to make money and profit from. And it's warms my heart when the mainstream once again turns to the community, turns to people, turns to activists and advocates, as Alex pointed out, for the answers, for what's right. And it's always refreshing to hear people embrace the idea of protections and in having incubators and welcoming industry and whatever new form it takes, that comes with a responsibility, that it's implied that it's not going to be a free for all. We've seen the sort of ill-got gains and the results, the debris, shall we say, the debris pattern of letting technology just go in any direction at whatever cost. It's especially important when we're working in an age of ever more precise information about ourselves, about that we want to hold close, or that needs to be in different modes across the technologies that we use. That should make that responsibility I'm talking about ever more a priority. So I'm heartened that we're all the answers.
Well, I gotta say, I feel pretty good about our community and about the people we are and the people we know, individuals, those standing up for freedom of speech, those sharing what they learn and brainstorming and coming up with better alternatives and fighting back. I salute everybody who takes part in that. And this is the time where we will be tested, and it's a time where we will succeed. It might take some time, but we will succeed, and we will create amazing things. Hey, have a great weekend, whether you're going to Vegas or to Holland or to Queens. You are going to meet all kinds of amazing people. And don't forget, you're an amazing person yourself, and enjoy the technology. Enjoy the challenges that lie ahead. You're not alone. And we will be back next week at this time with a one-hour program on WBAI. We will be back in a few minutes on Overtime on YouTube, channel 2600, talking about all kinds of other things. And please keep listening to WBAI and support WBAI. buddy.wbai.org or give to wbai.org. Rely on your support to keep going. It's hugely important. Have a good night.